Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today's podcast is one that I've been working on for quite some time, at least basically in my head, and I just hadn't really got there yet to talk about it out loud. But with some recent conversations with colleagues and then stuff on social media and whatnot, just finally pushed me to the point where I should talk about it today. My point is that no matter what aspect of emergency medicine you work in, this could be EMS, fast track, main ED, no matter the setting, geographically, rural, remote, urban, suburban, or whatever other factors, everyone who works in emergency medicine needs to be a resuscitationist, at least in my book. This is entirely my opinion, but I believe it's important and one worth your time for both reading and listening to this. Now, envision a busy night shift. It's 3 a.m, you still have a waiting room full of people who need to be seen in your small ED, and you're hours away from the next tertiary care center. There are scattered thunderstorms and your EMS is overwhelmed with all the difficult patients and transfers. You would swear it was a full moon, but when you go outside to get a quick breath of fresh air in all this chaos, you don't see one. Suddenly, though, you hear sirens in the distance and EMS reports are all coming in at once. Now, we've all been there and it's not easy and this night will not end. And just as you're truly getting busy, you hear the first EMS report. It's an attempted suicide with an overdose of unknown substances who's been vomiting and the airway cannot be secured yet by EMS. They mention that the patient's very bradycardic between the episodes of vomiting and that they've tried both medications and transcutaneous pacing without success. They have a 2-minute ETA and they require your immediate assistance. Now, this isn't a problem all by itself, but then the other reports start coming in. You have another EMS report of a head-on MVC with polytrauma with 2 patients with an approximately 2-minute ETA. One patient has obvious pelvic and open lower extremity fractures. The patient's coming in and out of consciousness, and there's been an obvious amount of blood that's been significant for this patient. The other person was ejected from the vehicle and has significant head and facial fractures. The trauma to the face is so significant that this patient has not been able to have an airway secured for them yet. EMS advises this is most likely going to be a surgical airway. You immediately start to align your staff and plan ahead for all this chaos that's about to endure when all of a sudden you hear from one of your experienced triage nurses that there's a 32-week pregnant patient with abdominal pain who just came in and has now suddenly collapsed. The triage nurse, seasoned, checks for a pulse, but she can't find one quickly. Now you're asking yourself, what do you do next? This is not easy. No matter who you are, this is a complex situation. This is one very difficult. But I don't care whether you're a tech, a nurse, a paramedic, NP, PA, or physician, anyone else for that matter. If you work in emergency medicine, you need to be able to resuscitate. You need to be able to do this. Maybe even if it's not an everyday situation, you may not even see this for weeks, months, who knows, even years. But our ability to resuscitate people should not be based on their geography. Sure, we may not have all the tools and resources that the urban tertiary care centers have, but we can still do a lot of good for our patients. Now, the situation I mentioned is truly overwhelming for pretty much any department, especially a community ED and one with solo coverage. But even if you have a second person, say this is a physician PA team, this is still going to be a truly difficult situation. Think about this for a second. That scenario I just described, within approximately 10-minute time frame, there's going to be 4 different airways, and 2 of which have a high risk of being surgical. Then you have another 2 or 3 people essentially requiring mass transfusion protocols, or at least you suspect it. All of them will most likely require pressure support. 1 may even need transvenous pacing, and 1 possibly could even need a resuscitative hysterotomy. This may seem like a fairy tale to you. This may seem like something that could never happen, but I guarantee you, every institution I've ever been in, this is something that happens. This is something that it may not happen quite like this, but there will be an overwhelming need for resources that can simply not be provided quickly because of the amount of critical patients. So what do you do about such events? Well, this is not the time that you're going to look up how to do a surgical airway or figure out all these dosings for medicines. A lot of this you need to know already in advance. This doesn't mean that you can't use some sheets for support or having something that you can refer to as need be. But this is not the time we're going to have the chance to look everything up in advance. This is at the time when you need to have those skills in place. If you're not at that level yet, you need to be quickly, especially if you have any chance in taking care of resuscitative patients. Now, if you're providing solo coverage, this is even a bigger deal because there's most likely not someone who's going to be able to back you up on this. And even if there was someone, you cannot rely on them. You need to be able to do these skills because even your colleagues who may be working in this field longer, they may not necessarily have the skills or knowledge in resuscitation either. And this is not something that, again, you want to have when you don't have the basic training. So if you're not at that level yet, what do you do? Well, this is a long, arduous process. There's no quick way to get there. However, some of the steps that you need to do are basically learning the basics and getting safe experience. Now, the merit badge courses like PALS, ACLS, and ATLS are all excellent jumping points and are usually often required anyway, but they are just the basics and will not suffice when it comes to managing these difficult situations. Attending courses like the difficult airway course or going to ultrasound courses, for example, or anything else where it requires advanced skills and lots of hands-on practice is what you need to do. The more time you can get hands-on, the better. If you can't do this where you can get experience directly by basically working in another department that may have this higher acuity, at least spend the time at conferences. And whatever you do, do not just leave early because the skills station, you've already done it all once. No, this is something practice as much as possible. There's no reason why not to spend a little more time practicing those skills whenever possible. Now, what about after that? How do you keep up the skills that you've just learned? How do you keep up your intubation skills? How do you keep up your different scenarios in managing these patients? Your mind is probably the best simulator out there in the whole world. You can run through cases and make them difficult. You can change them however you want. With time, you can make them more complex. You can also go through all the what ifs. Now, don't act like this is your board exam where you can simply say, well, I would secure an airway in this patient. What does that actually mean to you? Does this mean something where you're going to actually be thinking of the different steps? And this may start out really basic. Well, I'm going to get the laryngoscope. I'm going to get my medications. What are those medications? What type of laryngoscope? What blade? What size tube do you want? What are your ventilator settings going to be like? Not only what are you going to do for the initial procedure, but what's going to be your post-intubation sedation? All this stuff you need to start thinking about and start planning ahead. And the more and more detailed you can get, the more you can actually envision. Don't just think of a random patient. Think of a very specific case. Keep that in mind. Use what you can to build up your simulation as much as possible. Then run through other what-ifs. What if this patient becomes hypotensive? How could you have prevented that in the first place? But then also about what can you do to actually treat the hypotension? Play all this out in your mind and use these questions to build. Now, if you're lucky enough, and this varies by department, you'll have some degree of downtime. It may not feel like it right now. You may be in a busy time of year. It just all varies. But there are going to be those days when it's going to be low census. People start going home early. There may not be as many people on the tracker, or those that are on the tracker simply are just waiting for things to be done like labs. This is the perfect time to brush up on skills or even learn new ones. Now, something I really believe in is that every piece of equipment in the department, you should be able to not only look through and understand, but actually know how to use. If you have expired kits, try and get them. Or maybe they were a kit that was open but not used, and so the sterility is done. These are perfect for training purposes, and most facilities are happy to let you have them just for that purpose. They may keep them in the department so others can use them, but make sure you do this. This is not something that you want to have to look up how to use a chest tube kit and not know exactly what supplies you have and what you may need to get from other things, such as where your sterile gloves are, stuff like that. You need to know what are in your kits well in advance, how to use them, what specific tools are in what specific kits. All that stuff is stuff you need to know ahead of time. And this downtime is an excellent time to learn that. Now, as far as every piece of the equipment, I want you to think for a second. Do you know how to use your ventilator? Do you even have a ventilator in your department? Do you know how to use a level one infuser? Do you know how to use a slit lamp even? Now, a slit lamp may not be something for resuscitation, but it's one of those things that a lot of people just leave and sit in a dusty corner and that's the end of it. I was like that for a while. I eventually got the time to learn from someone who was very experienced in slit lamps and needed it for other purposes. And it was a great way to learn about it. And I've since built on it a lot more. I don't use the slit lamp, but at least I know how to use it if I ever specifically need that situation. The same thing should be said with any piece of equipment in the department. Now, what happens when you hit the point when you need to perform the skills above that you don't usually do on a daily basis? Now, maybe you're lucky enough to have specialists, but a lot of times they could be 30 or more minutes away, or at least they're not going to be in-house. And with the scenarios that I described to you, resuscitative thoracotomy or hysterotomy or stuff like that does not work well if you have to wait. These are things that usually have to be done right away. Now, I'm not suggesting that you do anything outside your scope of practice. You need to do what is appropriate and safe for your patients. And maybe you won't have certain things like ECMO or BOA or stuff like that. I know I don't have my shop right now, have that in the main place that I work at, but you still need to know at least the basics and how these are performed and where these patients should go if they need it. And it's important that you keep your privileges as broad as possible to allow for that to happen. You may even want to try and put in the stipulation for your privileges that you can perform advanced procedures as deemed appropriate on the emergent situation. And this needs to be as broad as possible because, for example, your privileging board may not even know necessarily what a resuscitative thoracotomy or hysterotomy even is, let alone if you have the experience for it. And you very well may not. It may be something that you've only had training on, and that's usually how it goes, is that these are such rare skills. But is this something in your scope, and is this something that you're privileged for? If you can say yes to both, then this puts you in a much better position, especially if you can keep this broad base. Now, as a warning, if you ever perform such high-level interventions, maybe not even the interventions, but you just have to make the tough calls on a critically ill patient, there's almost always going to be some sort of fallout later and some maybe even backlash from it. And you need to be prepared for this. One of the best talks ever I had from this was the late, great John Hines, who talked about crack the chest, get crucified. There's a link in the show notes, just like all this other stuff I'm talking about. Excellent, excellent talk. That's where the term recess wanker comes from. And really, it's something that we all should be listening to at least once in our life. I listen to it at least once a year because it's just such a good, solid talk. Now, knowing is simply not enough. You have to be able to make the decisions and have the leadership capabilities to lead this procedure to be performed or wherever skills need to be done. This is not the time when anyone needs to question what's going on. They need to be confident, and you need to be confident. Cliff Reed is probably the best speaker out there about how to make this happen. His talk, he's got two great ones that I'd recommend and that I've included in the show notes. Making Things Happen is the one about really how to guide a resuscitation, and then How to Be a Hero talks about a lot of the similar points, but it's really just a very motivational talk. I keep in mind, though, that this is all stuff you should be trying to share a mental model of well in advance. This is something that, again, with that downtime, maybe you know how to use all the stuff in your department. Maybe you feel very comfortable with it. Maybe this is not enough time to break open some kits and go through things, but it's enough time to maybe talk to a couple of nurses or whoever, whatever staff's available, to go through some situations and talk about, if this happens, this is what I would try and do. And this is a perfect time to do that. Just even a few minutes before a patient comes in, let's just say it's one of those patients. Run through that. Say, this is what I'm going to do in this situation. This is why we're going to do it. Are there any questions? Having that shared mental model in advance is going to make life a whole lot easier for you. Now, being a resuscitationist is never easy. And with the likes of Scott Weingart, Cliff Reed, John Hines, all of them, they are truly the experts. I am simply someone who's trying to get why I feel like we should all be doing more. And I would encourage you to check out Scott Weingart's Mind of the Resuscitationist series. I've included that also in the show notes on MCRIT. This is a really great site to go to. And in all reality, for all of us, this is going to take years, if not our entire lifetime, to be excellent resuscitationists, but it's worth this process just because we can better serve our patients and save lives. Now, again, I'm sure there's going to be lots of opinions on this, and you may feel like, hey, I work in fast track. I will never see this kind of patient ever. If you're thinking that, you probably haven't worked in a place yet or probably been in the situation yet where you've had a patient that initially seemed low priority and low key, who suddenly you find out that chest pain and cough is actually a STEMI and they're crashing right in front of you. This is still someone who needs resuscitation. This is not the time to say that you can't do any of this stuff. You need to be able to get at least the basics and know what you're going to do. And if this is something that you may feel like, I just don't feel comfortable with this. I just don't want to ever do this. I don't want you to do something that you don't feel comfortable with. And really, there are great places to go to where you may never have to deal with that situation. There are great walk-in clinics and urgent cares and stuff like that. Maybe there are large enough facilities with fast tracks that you maybe never have to do that. But if you're practicing in the rural remote setting, almost guaranteed you're going to have this situation, or at least you need to be helping in these situations. Even if this is not the day-to-day thing you do and you have other people in your department who do it, when you have a high acuity, high priority situation like this, you need to be able to help as much as possible, even if you're not going to be the main person. All right, I think I've went through a pretty good rant here. At least it kind of feels almost like a rant, but this is something I truly am passionate about. I hope you are too. I hope this may motivate you more. I'd really love your feedback. Please let me know. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere. Thank you for downloading another episode of Total EM. We want to thank our bandwidth sponsor, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this show. You can also see them on our website, but we also have included links to their website, funnyrx.com. Again, thank you, FunnyRx, for sponsoring this episode.